Thank you indeed for that fine address, Dr. Hunold. I know there'll be questions and comment, but we'll have our two other short addresses first, and then we'll have general question and discussion period after. The concluding words of Dr. Hunold and this passage from Repka may serve as a good transition to our next speaker. I don't know how many of you have picked up copies of this reprint, The Legacy of Wilhelm Repka, by our friend Hal Gordon, who's at the table over here. A very, very fine little essay. And there are still copies here. If any of you, after the conclusion of our discussion, want to get them, there are copies here available on the table. There's a passage which Mr. Gordon quotes from Repka, which is useful for a transition here. Repka wrote at one time, "My picture of man is fashioned by the spiritual heritage of classical and Christian tradition. I see in man the image and likeness of God. I am profoundly convinced that it is an appalling sin to reduce man to a means, even in the name of high-sounding phrases, and that each man's soul is something unique, irreplaceable, priceless, in comparison with which all other things are as naught." Now, Repka was one of the leading Christian social thinkers of our age, and so is our next speaker, Thomas Molnar. I suppose a good many here have already acquired copies of his very important and lucid book on the most difficult of all topics, God and the Nature of Reality. My wife is now making an intensive study of this book to equip herself for discourse with our second daughter, who is almost 8 years old. Our second daughter asks embarrassing questions. One day she was being facetious in her mother's study, and Annette told Cecilia to be quiet. Well, Cecilia did quiet down, but she said, "Would you like me to ask questions instead, Mama?" "All right," said Annette, "ask questions." "Very well," said Cecilia, who was then just past five or six. "Very well, Mama. Now, I can imagine a thing which has no end. But, Mama, I can't imagine a thing which has no beginning. Now, Mama, how is it that God has no beginning?" And Annette wasn't able to answer then, and so she's reading Thomas Molnar intensively to prepare for the answer of the nature of God and reality. Dr. Molnar is the author of many books, and there's another one coming forth very soon, Authority and Its Enemies. We're talking tonight about the good society and its enemies, and Dr. Molnar believes that a good society requires just authority. And he's talking about the enemies of just authority in this new book, soon to be published, Authority and Its Enemies. Well, Thomas Molnar has been involved in all kinds of controversies from an early age, involved intellectually and indeed physically. From his student days at a university in Belgium, when he was arrested by the Gestapo and carried off to a concentration camp, ever since those days he's been controversial in a very healthy sort of way. He's suffered much with high courage and high imagination. And many of you, of course, know his books. His books, which are a vigorous assertion of enduring truths. Some of you know his critical studies of Berlioz and Sartre and Teilhard de Chardin. Some of you know his very important book, I think it's his best one, really, with the possible exception of God and the Nature of Reality. My favorite book of his is The Decline of the Intellectual, which has had a wide circulation. Many of you have copies of his Utopia, The Perennial Heresy. Others have his books on the present state of the church and of Christian dogma and doctrine. And some of you certainly know his book on Southwest Africa. He's a great traveler. And his African Travelogue, a separate book, in which your chairman of Evening figures as a figure of fun. I wrote in my column that I was rather a figure of fun in his book. He and I, Mr. Mullen and I, traveled together throughout Africa. And he wrote to me in grief, wondering how I had made that interpretation of my appearance in his pages. But I told him I was delighted. I delight in being a figure of fun, a clown wandering through Africa in company with Dr. Molnar. We did indeed have many adventures. Mr. Molnar, had he only time, could tell you of the interesting week in which we spent in the surrealistic landscape of the Oasis of Marrakesh, in company with Jackie Kennedy, Haile Selassie, and 10,000 Berbers firing flintlocks. That's only one of our adventures. All quite true. But he's not talking about that tonight. Instead, he's going to offer us certain considerations on Pilum Repka. Dr. Moeller.
Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I did not make fun of Russell Kirk. I merely mentioned that in the hottest days in Tunis and indeed Marrakesh, he was walking around dressed far more warmly than he is dressed now, and that the street urchins of Casablanca were running after us, wondering who is this man who is dressed in heavy woolen stuff in the blazing hot sun of the souks of Marrakesh, and wondering about that heavy shoe, those heavy stockings, that heavy stick, and of course the eternal necktie pin, which was the same then as it is now. But other than that, I never made fun of Russell Kirk. Now, as the second lion, to use Dr. Hunold's description, I must say that I have, of the three speakers here, least right to speak about Wilhelm Röpke. Here is Dr. Hunold, almost a lifelong friend and companion of Röpke. There is Dr. Bormann, a student of Röpke and a close friend of his. And here am I, who met Röpke only a few times in Switzerland. We had long, long conversations. We exchanged several letters, but after all, I cannot claim that I knew him half as well as these two gentlemen. However, I have one memory which I should perhaps tell you about. It was in 1941-42 in Budapest, when the Hungarian government, then ally of Germany, thought that maybe Germany would, after all, lose the war, and therefore it might be a good idea to play against Hitler and with the Allies. But this could not be done manifestly and openly. So very likely the publishers, Hungarian publishers, were encouraged to seek on the free European market books that might be published in Hungary as a kind of trial balloon, that if these books might be accepted, or rather not objected to, by the Germans or the friends of Germany, then perhaps a little bit more movement can be made in the right direction. And this is how my parents bought me the book Humane Economy in Hungarian translation in 1941 or two, I do not remember, because that was one of the chief books, together with a book of Huizinga, which the Hungarian publisher thought that it would not only make an excellent market, because people would just buy it up eagerly, but that it would also be a kind of signal of the intentions of the Hungarian government, which they could not openly merchandise. So my acquaintance with Röpke dates back to 1941, and under these circumstances, which, as I said, Röpke appeared as a symbol of freedom in then-encircled Hungary. However, that does not mean that Röpke does not need at all times, and even today, and even before this audience, what I would say is not only a reaffirmation of a very great man and his ideas, but almost, I would say, a vindication. Because I have found that even in American conservative circles, and in spite of Henry Regnery's great and laudable efforts of printing and distributing his books, to which the ISI has forcefully contributed, there is still a kind of Röpke unknown quantity in the United States, and even before conservatives. There are other great giants. There is Hayek, there is von Mises, and there are others, but somehow it seems to me Röpke is in the shadow. And I think that it is very necessary that Röpke should not be in the shadow, and that while I cannot bring up all the quotations that Dr. Hunold just mentioned about Röpke's greatness and about his mend the measure philosophy, which is not at all the same as that of the sophist Protagoras, it would be important that precisely to fight those various excesses, the excesses of collectivism certainly, but also the excesses of individualism, that for this purpose, Röpke should be better known and more often quoted. What book the previous speaker did not mention, although he sent me a copy a few weeks ago from Switzerland, is the letters of Röpke, which had just appeared in Switzerland, in German, and of which, as I said, I had an early copy, and which I read a few weeks ago before coming here. And indeed, it is one of the best ways to get to know the man Röpke, who in the intimacy of private letters tells us very much about himself, things that the reader may not receive from reading his more specialized books. And in this volume, I found a Röpke who is a mild and soft man, a charming man, a gentleman of the old world kind, at the same time a man who is not mincing words when it comes to people whom he dislikes. He has very strong dislikes, just as much as he has likes. In other words, he is not the lukewarm man that Dr. Hunold quoted. He knew what was hot and cold. He was a fearless fighter and uncompromising on principles, with undying loyalties, I should say. And I think that by listing some of his dislikes here, we can get a better picture of the man than a whole lot of eulogy. His dislikes were not necessarily in this order. United Europe, which I'm very glad to see, because it is also my conviction, is a horrible plan. Europe was not made to be united. It would be a dreadful common market of all sorts of vulgarities. But Röpke very consciously fought it from the very beginning, including, of course, the nucleus of United Europe, the common market. Because he saw that in this day and age especially, we are not in the age of the Christiana Respublica. In other words, there was once, in the Middle Ages, a not united, not even federated, but an intellectually and especially spiritually common thinking Europe. Well, that is one thing. But today, these days, Röpke understood that this would be a socialist Europe, and above all, an ideological Europe, to keep that very varied continent together. And he even added that this would be a united, amorphous thing without a national base. In other words, with the best interpretation, we can say that Röpke was also, although not a nationalist in the modern ideological sense, but he was a patriot and he did understand the necessity of nations rooted in their past and in the national idea. Therefore, it is so sad to see, as I read in a magazine article recently, in the To the Point, which is published in Antwerp, and which tries desperately to be a kind of imitation Newsweek, I read that the leader of the German Christian Democratic Party, the CDU, which after all Röpke had much to inspire through the personality of Ludwig Erhard, that the present president of that party, Helmut Kohl, said that we should work for a free, pluralistic European society committed solely to the well-being of the individual, not a word of the common good, and therefore this whole project, besides that it will not succeed, carries in itself already the seeds of ideological destruction, because it is not only the individual who is important, but listening to those words that Dr. Hunold quoted about individualist excesses, the common good is also important, and the balance between the two is the essence of freedom. United Europe was one of his and perhaps chief enemies. The second, I could not say enemy, because after all, he lived a long part of his life in Geneva, the city of Calvin. But Calvinism was not what Röpke particularly cherished. He was a Lutheran. Don't forget that he was the son of a Lutheran pastor. But as he himself reminds us in his letters now, this Lutheranism that he learned at his family house from father, grandfather, and further back, was very sympathetic to the Catholic tradition. It was a kind of, which one can still find in many parts of Europe and even of Germany, it's a kind of Catholic Protestantism or Protestant Catholicism, anyway, in the spirit of European common thinking, referring back to the Christiana Respublica. This kind of Protestantism is what Röpke cherished, and not the fanaticism that he saw in Calvinism. Immediately after that, his next opponent were the opponents of the gold standard. I'm mixing my list here, but I give it to you as it seemed to me to be important in Röpke's own estimation. So after the cultural political issues, he came to the economic issue and very strongly opposes in his letters those who oppose the gold standard. The next one was Keynes. Keynes, and immediately next to Keynes, surprisingly, Adlai Stevenson, as he found him on his trip to Buenos Aires. As you see, there is a geographical mixing of regions here also. He found Stevenson in Argentina when he himself was there lecturing, and he says in his letter that the lot of nonsense that Stevenson said to the Argentine newspaper man has revolted him, and he has there a long quotation about the things that he said. And now, not to be too far away from the Stevensonian ideology, the next thing that comes on the list of his enemies was those idiots, he says, because he did not mince words, especially not in his letters, who enforced democracy on Japan. This he discovered in Tokyo, where he said that Japanese were so grateful to him that he did not come there as a lecturer to lecture to them on the wonderful benefits of democracy. Now, that does not mean that Röpke was not a Democrat. After all, he stood up, as you just heard, in the most fierce fashion to Hitlerism, and he came back to Switzerland because he found democracy there again. But he said that one should not destroy the national identity of a nation. And the national identity of Japan was not necessarily leading Japan into the ideologically democratic camp. Then another enemy, or enemies rather, were the weak-kneed, I'm quoting, intellectuals, those who yield to mobs and mob pressure. And in a letter to me, he writes, I think it was in 1964, that even my good old friends, Röpke's good old friends, maybe since nobody knows them here, I shall mention, except Dr. Hunold, who will know them, Hans Barth and Werner Kegi, two great Swiss scholars, and he calls them weak-kneed intellectuals who yield to the mobs. Why was this the case? Dr. Hunold and I were in a way tangentially involved in this, because when Dr. Hunold organized in Zurich a series of lectures about African nationalism, and I was one of the speakers there, and Röpke was another speaker, then, of course, we said the truth as we saw it, as we experienced it in Africa just recently. And then the whole Swiss press, the leftist press, and the weak-kneed liberal press, started attacking, first of all, Dr. Hunold as the organizer of this series of lectures, and then all those who have been associated with it. And Röpke, of course, stood up to it, just as Dr. Hunold did, and he said that Hans Barth and Werner Kegi were yielding visibly and every day. So from this too, you see that Röpke did not shun controversial issues and that he stood up at all times for what he believed to be true. And then I come to the last, the list of the enemies. It was a common enemy, common to Wilhelm Röpke and to myself and perhaps to many other people. And this I also have in one of his letters to me, and he said, it seems that we agree on every issue, he said to me, which was a great pleasure for me, of course, to read. But most of all, we agree in condemning that fool, Teilhard de Chardin. Now, with this, of course, he won my heart. He would have won it if he hadn't done it already before. But I think that it should be mentioned that in this list of these very heterogeneous enemies, there is a kind of line running through. He disliked cowardly men, he disliked fanatics, and he disliked ideologues. And I think this is common to all of us here, and therefore it was necessary to bring to you Röpke's posthumous message in this respect. In conclusion, I should only like to say a word of my own, because during these 2 days at the Philadelphia Society, I was thinking, naturally thinking ahead to the words that I will tell you tonight, what would Röpke's reaction be to this gathering, to this meeting? And I think that the one best way to sum up what his reaction would have been is to quote again from a letter of Röpke's to the great Italian philosopher Benedetto Croce, whom he knew well, with whom he disagreed on many issues, namely on Croce's committed Hegelianism, but with whom he maintained very excellent and courteous relations. And there is a letter, which I merely summarize in one sentence, in which he says that the market economy cannot be and is not a goal in itself. It is merely a way of allowing other higher values. Now, I'm not here to elaborate on what Röpke meant here, or what he would have meant, or what he would have said to some of the debates that took place last night and today. But I think it is good to remember, and this is why I began my words with the necessity of vindicating Röpke, namely of making him not only sound the wonderful man and thinker that he was, but to bring him a little bit closer to American conservatism, because we tend to disregard him on several, I think, to him, fundamental issues, namely of understanding, again in terms of fighting excesses on both sides, that technical things like market economy can only be servants, and this is not a humble role, it is a very exalted role, to higher values. And Dr. Hunold quoted here what Röpke considered as the measure of man, namely his relationship to God. That means, that is a whole message, that is a very rich content there. And therefore, I think that my conclusion in vindicating Röpke is to make him present here in his absence, and to express, as I try to do, the ideas for which he stood, and which ideas must be brought into harmony with ours, or rather, our ideas must be brought in closer harmony with Röpke's own. Thank you very much.